I've seen the video like 4 times. Got me every time. I mean, this is not part of my deal, right? But that's why we exist, right? Is there anything better? Is there anything better than seeing people and, you know, the knowing the stories of the people and hearing them tell their own stories and then talk about how God has changed them? Like, what else is there to live for? So, anyway, I don't know where to go from here. other than, if this is your first time here, that's what we're about as a community. I've only been here for 3.5 months now, and that's why I'm here. It's because that's what we're about. So, all right, so after service today, by the way, there's this thing called Harbor Serves, and it's going to be an opportunity for you to sign up and serve somewhere here. And honestly, it's not about we want people at the door greeting, or it's not because we want people to hold babies. It's because we want people to feel comfortable. People are not spiritually aware until they're environmentally comfortable. And so if people had to come in here and hold their own babies, if they didn't want to, some people, if you want to, then hold your baby. But if you don't want to and you have to, then you're not, you know, comfortable. So you're not spiritually aware. And so when we ask you to sign up and serve, it's not because we want people busy. It's because we want to make the way wide that leads to life. The Bible says narrow is the way that leads to life. And we believe that everyone who steps up, who serves, who uses their gifts is widening that way. And so, like, for instance, like right now in second service, there's no one in the purple room, which is babies. And so what happened in the second hour is if someone comes and they bring a baby, 0 through 3, or 6 months through 3 or something, they either hold the baby in service or they leave. And so that's second hour here. And so we don't want people to sign up because, you feel like you have to, but because we want that person with the baby who may be far from God, we want them to be able to sit and learn and have their life change. Maybe next time the video plays, they're the one dunking underwater and they're the one making me cry. So that's why. So if you don't serve anywhere and you normally attend first, think about signing up and holding baby second hour or any of those other areas. All right? All right. I did my duty. So we're in this series called Throughline, which is basically why we as a church exist. And a throughline in a story is that theme or that the backbone of a story. It's the constant motion forwards. You know, in the movie E.T., it's E.T. wants to get home. You know, E.T. phone home, right? You know, this is the throughline of E.T. And something like Moana, she wants to leave home to save home and get back home to a safe home. Like, this is the throughline of these stories. And the author who's writing the story, they use a through line to keep the action moving forward. And it helps them understand why they're telling a story, and so they don't get bogged down in things like setting or conversations, but the story keeps moving towards an eventual mission-critical goal. And so anyway, so this is what a through line is. And so what we're doing in these 3 weeks is talking about the through line for Harbor and why we exist as a community and what value we add and also for you guys personally, what it means to be part of Tribe Harbor, like what it means to be part of the group and what it means to have our core values in your life. This is what it means. And so 2 weeks ago, we said what it means to be part of Harbor is to live fully. And then last week, we said love deeply. And then today, we're going to talk about giving freely. And so that being said, some of you have noticed and asked me about, and some of you have noticed but not asked me about. And actually, John outed me on this before I even came here, is that I kind of have this fascination with sneakers. Right, and some of you, I heard some of you say it before I got to the word out. Right, and people ask me like, how many pairs of sneakers do you have? And I said, I honestly don't know. But I counted this morning before I left, and I have 12 pairs of sneakers that I wear on like regular rotation basis out and about. And I have like other ones that are like, you know, for yard work, but I don't really count those. But so the answer is 12. So I've had a lot of people ask me, And I don't really like the fact that I like sneakers. Like, I grew up playing basketball and in a time when basketball was kind of like a cultural thing, and there was, you know, the greatest player of all time was around when I was a kid, you know, Michael Jordan, and his shoes were like these iconic things. And so, I don't know, I just kind of grew up in a time when basketball and basketball sneakers were just sort of, they went together hand in hand. I grew up playing basketball. And so I kind of fell in love with sneakers. And I don't love that about me. Like, I kind of wish I didn't like sneakers as much as I do. My wife definitely wishes I didn't like sneakers as much as I do. Not only do I have like 12 pairs of sneakers around the house, but I wear a size 13, and so it's like hurdling, you know, the Olympic hurdlers to get through our living room sometimes. Yeah, she's like, yes, definitely. And because they're not only everywhere, but they're kind of big. And so anyway, so I like sneakers. Online right now, there's this pair of sneakers. If you are particularly good at things like Where's Waldo, you would notice that I'm actually wearing a very similar pair of sneakers today, okay? But this pair is very specific because this pair online right now is selling for $16,000, okay? And it's because they were game-worn by Michael Jordan in his rookie season, and they have since been signed. Okay, so 84, these things came out, and he has since signed them, and he wore them in a game his rookie year, and you can go to eBay right now, and for the low cost of $15,999, you too can own a pair of sneakers. Okay, so I love, like I said before, I like sneakers, but imagine for a second, if all the sneakers I've ever owned were on a table here, okay, and this pair was on the table here, and someone said, all right, you can pick. Which would you rather have? I would obviously, in the blink of an eye, without having to think twice, say, I will take that pair, right? Because I could sell them and buy all of these and still have enough money to, I don't know, go on the fattest vacation ever or something, right? Like, that's an amazing pair of shoes, and the value there is so much greater than the shoes I've ever owned before. And so even though I like sneakers and have kind of like, you know, got a little collection going, I would drop them instantly, without missing a beat, without thinking twice, for this one pair, because the value here is so much greater. It so supersedes. And it's not just the monetary value, but that's a pretty cool story, right? Like, these sneakers were worn by the man himself his rookie year before he was who he is today. It's like, wow, that's a pretty cool story, right? And so, and I would definitely, I would take them. I don't want to see these ever again because I have this, right? That would be an easy choice. So there's this passage in the Bible, and it's this thing called a parable. And a parable is a metaphor that tells a story, that communicates a truth. And there's this parable in the Bible about a guy who discovers a hidden treasure in a field. And it's from Matthew 13:44. And this verse, it's the beginning and the end of the parable. It's not this long. Some parables are several verses long or a chapter long. This parable is one verse long. 13:44 is the entire thing. It says this: the kingdom of heaven is like a treasure that a man discovered hidden in a field. In his excitement, he hid it again and sold everything he owned to get enough money to buy the field. And so it's this guy who's going along. He's walking home, and on his journey home, he like stubs his toe, or he sees in the corner of his eye, you know, like a treasure. And I don't know I was trying to think of how they would bury treasure. I don't picture it like in a pirate, you know, chest. Arr, you know, I don't picture that. Like maybe like a bag with like a money sign on it, or I don't know, like what it would be, you know. But somehow, like, he's walking home and he noticed there's a treasure, and so he covers it back up, and he goes off and he sells everything he owns, because he buys the field so that he can legally and not underhandedly own the treasure. Because this thing he's discovered is far more valuable to him instantaneously than the rest of his life, everything he's ever accrued up until that moment. And so we talk about everything he's ever accrued his whole life and the value of that, not just monetarily, but to him, on one hand, and this newly discovered treasure on the other. And he says instantaneously, this is of no value comparatively to this, which I had discovered. Which is kind of a weird story. Like, why would someone bury treasure? So I looked into this a little bit. There's only one pirate throughout history that it says definitely buried his treasure around. But there was one pirate. The Vikings would do it. I learned that this week. That Vikings, when they would take over like an island or something, they would on the island take treasure from the people and then bury it on the island so that if the boat went down, the treasure would still be accessible. There's actually about 7 years ago, there was an eccentric millionaire who buried $2 million worth of jewels in New Mexico and then released a map and a poem to find it, and no one's ever found it. This is a true story. Like, I'm not making this up. The guy named Forrest Finn. And so right now, somewhere in New Mexico, there's $2 million hidden in the ground somewhere. And there's a map and a poem that leads you there. By the way, before you run off to New Mexico, two people have died so far looking for it. This is a true story. It's the craziest thing. A friend of mine who actually comes here, who used to live southwest from here, that'll make sense in a second. His father, when his father thought his mother was going to leave him, got really, really drunk and took all of his life savings and went out into the desert and buried it. And the next morning, couldn't remember where he buried it and hasn't found it since. And so my friend is telling me this story. I'm like, oh my goodness, your dad sounds like a character. He's like, you have no idea. Like, this is not the crazy thing my dad's ever done. I was like, okay, that's intense. But actually, in this time, in this era, what would happen is these people who Jesus was talking to, they were occupied by the Roman Empire. And so the Roman Empire, they would kind of do sweeps, and they would come in, and they would steal valuables constantly. And so the people who lived in their homes, and maybe they were sort of nomads that live in tents, they would bury their valuables underground, some distance away from where they lived, so that when people would come in, that they couldn't take their valuables from them. And this idea of burying valuables was a common thing. It was they didn't have like banks that they trust like today. So they would bury they would just bury their valuables in the ground and then go back and get them later so no one could steal them from them. And so the idea that someone found valuables would have been a much more common thing back then. So this person, he's going through, he discovers valuables. Clearly this person who owns the field doesn't realize there's valuables there because they're willing to sell it. And now he owns the treasure. What this doesn't, however, communicate is what the metaphor is. The kingdom of heaven is like a treasure that a man discovered hidden in a field. In his excitement, he hid it again and sold everything he owned to get enough money to buy the field. There's two metaphors here. There's the person and there's the treasure. And before we go any further, in your own mind, try and figure out, like, all right, the person metaphorically is this person or thing. The treasure metaphorically is this person or thing. Like, what do you guys think? Like, in your own mind, like just don't yell it out because people are going to see it differently. What do you think this metaphor is, this allegory is? Like, who is the person? Who or what is the treasure? What do you guys think? So if you guys think that you are the person, and that I'm going to say that God is the treasure. Let me see your hand. Anybody? All right. If you think that God is the person and you are the treasure, anybody? Hand? Is anybody who's just like, I have no idea? I have an idea, but I didn't want to say it or raise my hand because I didn't want to be wrong. Anybody though? Yeah, a couple. Okay. What's fascinating about this is when you read commentaries on this passage, which is basically like scholars who are talking about passages, they see it. There isn't one specific, like, this is what it means. And some of Jesus' parables, he like circles back around and he says, actually, what this parable means is da 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 da. He never does that with this. So you can have to look at the parable and figure it out. So the kingdom of heaven is like a treasure that a man discovered hidden in the field. In his excitement, he hid it again and sold everything he owned to get enough money to buy the field. See, this parable doesn't work unless it's not an either or, but a both and. Here's what I mean. It doesn't work unless Jesus is the man who gave up everything for you, which is a treasure that was worth far more than his own life. This is an accurate and helpful explanation of the parable. But if he gives up his life for you, which is the treasure, and you aren't willing to give up everything for him in return, his sacrifice was not worth it. But if you are, let's say it goes like this, you are the man and you are willing to give up everything for your relationship with Jesus and all that you've ever accrued up until now, you value him more than that stuff and that junk. But he didn't value you over his own life, then your choice wasn't worth it. See, this parable, I love it so much. It's so valuable because it's not an either or. It has to be a both and. Both. He gave up his whole life for you, which is the treasure that was worth more to him than his life. And in response to that generosity, in response to that love, in response to the generosity to the point of self-sacrifice, we give up everything for him, which is the treasure. It has to be the sort of like cycle of both and of he gives up and we give up and he gives up and we give up. Another way of saying it is you're never more like Jesus than when you are generous to the point of self-sacrifice. Let me say it again. You are never more like Jesus than when you are generous to the point of self-sacrifice. Because he gave up everything for you, and the only response that makes any sense is for you to give up everything in response to him. And what this looks like and what this means is a life sold out, completely committed, devoted to him because of the sacrifice that he made. And so that everything you've, like this story goes, everything that you've ever done and valued and accomplished and loved pales in comparison to this. And what you know after you've done this, after you've made that commitment, is when you are marked and shaped by this love and generosity that he offered you, then this gives back and you appreciate and you delight in those things that you gave up for him in the first place. And so this idea of just being, holding on to this life loosely because he held on to his life loosely, is this something that should fuel and fill and should mark the way that we live our life? Like this parable here, it's so beautiful because it's both and. He gave up everything for you, and so he asks you to give up everything in response to him. But he's not asking you to do anything he didn't already do for you. And it's just a cycle of back and forth and both. And I love it. But what happens over time is eventually, let's say someone enters into a relationship with Jesus, and we just showed videos of people who they're committing to publicly love and pursue Jesus, and they were being baptized, and it's an amazing thing, and it moves me like little else does. But eventually, in their lives, like all of our lives, they will be going through life, as you and I will, as inevitably. And something will happen in life, or something will be tested in our life, or a choice will have to be made. I feel like God's calling me to this, but I don't want to give that up. So I'm not going to. So I'm going to choose this path instead. This has happened several times in the Bible where Jesus is going through and he's walking around and he's telling about who God is and what God sent him to do, and he's healing people, and people come up to Jesus and they say, "I will follow you anywhere." And Jesus says a response, and the people walk away and we never hear from them again. It happens several times. But for instance, one example is there's this guy who's a rich young ruler. He comes up to Jesus and he says, "Jesus, I will follow you anywhere." And Jesus says, "Great, sell all that you own, give it to the poor, and follow me." And he walks away sheepishly, and we never hear from him again. Another time what happens is Jesus volunteers and asks the person. He says, you, I want you to follow me. You can do what I do. He's like, yes, I will go. But first, let me bury my father, which is a cultural thing, right? Like, so either his father was dying or was dead. And he says, I just want to go and I want to bury my father. And this is very culturally significant because the father is like the patriarch or the head of the home. And he's like, I want to honor the patriarch of my family. And then I will leave. And if this guy who asked Jesus, who Jesus asked to follow him, doesn't do that, his family will shun him forever. And Jesus' response is, let the dead bury the dead. You follow me. This seems like very hard. It seems like Jesus is painting him into a corner. Or another time, someone says, Jesus, I will follow you anywhere. And he says, foxes have holes, but the Son of Man, which was Jesus' nickname for himself, does not have a place to rest his head. He says, basically, I'm homeless. I live an uncomfortable life. But you, if you follow me, I mean, it looks glamorous. Like I'm walking around, I'm healing people, I'm talking about God, and people are coming in droves. And yes, you want to be part of that. But the flip side of this is I'm homeless. I live an uncomfortable life. So yes, you follow me, but know that you're committing to an uncomfortable life. And the guy's like, nah. And so he walks away, never heard from again. You see, what's happening in these stories of these people who are saying, I may or may not pursue Jesus, is Jesus is doing in their lives suddenly what he does in our lives over time. You see, if you begin to believe in Jesus, eventually what will happen is there will be a fork in the road where you say, I'm either going to choose to follow Jesus and give up my life before, or I'm going to stick to my life before, and I'm not going to be obedient in this, and this path diverges. And what happens in life is like we go through and we begin faith in Jesus, and he says, all right, I want you to make these choices for me. Make this choice for me. And we're like, yes, yes, I'll make that choice. I want you to make this other choice over here for me. Yes, yes, I'll make that choice. I want you to make this choice for me, even though it's going to be hard. And we say, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to, you know, be generous with my money. I'm not going to be generous with my time. I'm not going to be generous with my identity. And so it's like a gears in a clock that are working together well, and then they just stop. It's like you ever seen a kid who's going down a slide and they're progressing nicely and they stick suddenly. Like this is what happens in our lives sometimes where we're going through life and we say, yes, God, I will give you everything. I will give you, yes, give me that. Yes, I'll give that to you. Give me that. Yes, I'll give that to you. Give me that. No, I won't give that to you. Don't, by the way, don't ask for that. Don't mention that again. Like that is me and that's mine. Don't touch that. What this parable says is the kingdom of God is like a man who is willing to give up everything. His money, his identity, his comfort, his stuff, his lifestyle, in exchange for God. This is what this parable is talking about. So just like Jesus did suddenly and for those three people, like eventually in your life, you will have to make choice after choice. Do I pick Jesus or do I pick this thing? Do I pick Jesus or my money? Do I pick Jesus or my time? Do I pick Jesus or my stuff? And you will get to the point where it's a very hard decision. It's inevitable. And so what are the reasons? Like, what does this look like in your life? What is this? If you are going to make that choice that I'm going to pick Jesus and not this other thing that's going on. Like what are the reasons why sometimes we don't do that? And the reason oftentimes, more often than not, the reason why we are not generous with our money, the reason why we are not generous with our stuff and our time and our talents, more often than not is because we are afraid. I mean, if I am generous with my money, then maybe it's a little too tight. And maybe my life gets a little more uncomfortable. If I am genuinely generous with my money. And by the way, just so you know, like I'm not picking on money. Actually, so the Bible talks about prayer a couple hundred times. The Bible talks about faith 500 times. The Bible talks about money and how we use it and approach it 2,000 times. And so what I think happens is God knew that when we were going to get to this fork in the road, more often than not, the thing that was going to throw us off was how we use our money. And so but I'm not just talking about money. I'm talking about our money. I'm talking about our values. I'm talking about our time. I'm talking about the way we serve. And so, but more often than not, that moment where we say, yes, I will give this to you, God. Yes, I will give this to you, God. Yes, I'll give this to you, God. I want you to be generous with your money. No, not only am I not going to, don't bring it up again, please. Right? This is the sticking point for many of us. But we choose to not be generous. We choose to not give freely because we are afraid of what might happen if we are. And we know that God makes promises like he'll take care of all of our needs if we're generous, if we live with this generosity as a lifestyle. But you have to take that first step to live generous before he can respond and take care of needs. And that first step is a doozy. And so we don't because we're afraid, which reminds me of a story. So a couple years ago, John Emery and I were spearfishing in the Bahamas. That's true, by the way. This is us. This is not us spearfishing, actually, but this is us in the Bahamas together. And so John and I are in the Bahamas, and we're leading groups of teenagers to serve in an HIV/AIDS community. And one day we get up super early. Like, we have to get up at like 7 a.m. to go into the work site. And we're like this, but we're going to get up at like 5 a.m. or 4:30, and we're going to go spear fishing in the ocean at sunrise. And so we do. John and I go spear fishing. This is probably like 5 years ago in this coral reef off the coast of the Bahamas at like 5 o'clock in the morning. And so at one point, he shoots a squid. At one point, he was charged at by an octopus. I'm not making this up at all. Like, this is completely true. I saw the largest lobster I've ever seen in my entire life, and I was told it's very illegal to shoot it because that was like mating season. If you kill that one lobster, you might be killing like 20 or something. So don't, if they see you with a dead lobster, you're in big trouble. So I didn't shoot the lobster. And so anyway, so we're swimming along, and John and I, and I have goggles on and flippers and and what's that called? Snorkel, thank you. You're all paying attention. I like that. And so we're swimming along, and I see this. I see probably a distance from me to him right here, a 7-foot shark. So John's immediate reaction was, let's shoot it. True, it's a completely true story. He's like, can we shoot it? What? So have you ever, it's like somewhere between like the Flintstones and Wile E. Coyote. What happened was, or Jesus, I got up on top of the water and ran away. No. No, I didn't actually. But I was afraid out of my mind. Also, I think that's kind of like an interesting personality difference where I was like, I want to be anywhere but here. And he was like, can we shoot it? Okay, so we're like swimming along. We see the shark. It's like from me to the table. And I'm terrified. And the guy who's with us, I haven't mentioned yet, there's a mutual friend there. He taps me and so I poke my head up. And he's like, hey man, just so you know, like, you're terrified, but that's actually what's called a nurse shark. And the shark looked just like that because it was resting on the bottom of the ocean. And there's only one type of shark in the whole world that sleeps sitting still on the bottom of the ocean, because normally when sharks sit still, they suffocate. But this shark was like from me to here, and it was just sitting on the bottom of the ocean, about to get shot. You know, what did it do, right? Which means that that shark was not dangerous. And the guy I was with, he had information that let him know this shark was not dangerous, but I had no idea the shark was not dangerous, so I was terrified of it. Just beyond terrified of this shark. Like, oh my goodness, get me out of here right now. I mean, when you see like a 7-foot shark in the wild and you're like 6 feet from it, whew, terrifying. This is what I kind of feel like happens when we make this choice at this crossroads of, am I going to give this to God or am I not? Because we become terrified of this thing that was never dangerous to us. See, what happens is we say, God, like, you want me to give you my time. You want me to give you my money. You want me to live generously. You want me to live in such a way that you've called me to, but I'm afraid of it. And he's like, man, don't you understand? This thing you're afraid of, it was never dangerous for you. Because I've made you promises that I will take care of you. I've made you promises that I will think through and consider all of your needs. So this thing, like me with the shark, that I was terrified of, that it had no danger for me, like when we are obedient, when we pursue God, when we put God above all else, when we are willing to give freely, the first step is always a step in fear. That step, let me tell you, when you take that step, you will always be afraid. Every time. And that step has no danger for you because he has already made you promises. So you know what? Well, you know, by the way, there's these two magicians named Penn and Teller, and they are looked down on by other magicians because they give away the trade secrets. And so there's a thing called the Ring of Honor that they've been told they're never being. And so I'm about to give away a trade secret. You ready? When people up here talk about things like money or generosity or valuing God above all else, you know what happens? For 1 week, giving goes up. And then the next week, it's back down again. Because people in the seats, be generous, give to God freely. Fine. Next week, my conscience is clear, right? I don't feel guilty, right? Like, and so what happens is whether they say it or not, like, we, people of my ilk, my people, like we, yes, give freely to God. He wants you to give freely. Choose him above all else. Boom. And then you give, and you relieve the own sense of personal guilt about, oh, I never give money to God. Ah, I gave money today. $20, I feel better, right? This is what happens. You should live generously. Boom. I feel guilty. Now I feel better. And we're good. All right. See, if this today, if as I'm talking about this, as I'm talking about giving freely, as I'm talking about valuing God above all else, and using our money and our time and our talents for him, like if any part of you is like, man, okay, I feel a little guilty about this. I have not, because honestly, I'll just be very honest with you. I have no idea who gives money to this place. I have no idea. If you give money, great. I have no idea. I promise you. I don't know what a single person gives here. But I asked for numbers. And I found out that half the people who regularly attend here give $0 a year. About a quarter of the people give like $5, $10 on average a week, you know. And then almost the entire budget of this place is made up by that last quarter or less. I found that out this week. And so what happens is these 50% who never give anything or the 25%, they're like, fine, here's this. I feel guilty, so I'm going to give you $20. Now I feel better. Now, where was I? Patriots football, right? This is what happens. You know what the Bible says? There's this verse. It says that's going to appear here. It says that there is no... next one, I'm sorry. I went out of order. It says this in Romans 8:1. So now there is no condemnation for those who belong to Christ Jesus. And basically what this means is condemnation is basically guilt. What this verse says is there is no guilt for those that pursue Jesus. And so if you're sitting here and you're like, man, like I... If the inner monologue is honestly like I do not use my money, like I've come to this fork in the road and I have chosen to not support and give things, give my money, use my time, use my talents for God, and I would rather him not ask me. But I'm going to today because I feel guilty. This verse says there is no guilt for those who, like there's no, like if you were going to give today financially because you felt guilty, then don't do it. I'm telling you, don't do it. If you were going to be the one who's going to like, oh, fine. Don't do it. Because I don't want your money. I don't want you to feel guilty. I'd rather you not sign up to serve here than sign up because you feel guilty, because that's not what Jesus came to do. That's not me leading you towards him. That's me using guilt to motivate. And that's not what we're about. What I do want is for you to value him above everything else. And then not to give money today, but give him the rest of your life. And so this idea of like, I'm going to give, I feel better, and back down. I don't want that. That's not what, there is no guilt in Jesus. So that's you. If that was your plan today, don't do it. I don't want your 20 bucks. I do want you to give the rest of your life to God. I was telling my wife the other day about this sermon, and she said sort of like off the cuff, and when the prophetess speaks, you listen. She said, oh, you're asking people to live by faith, not fear. And I was like, yes, that's good. I will use that. That's true. Live by faith, not fear. Don't give your 20 bucks today out of guilt. Don't do anything out of guilt. Because if you feel guilty in response to something, that's not Jesus moving you along. His thing is not about making you live in this like yoke of guilt. It's about setting you free. So give him your entire life. Don't give him 20 bucks today. Where was I? I have no idea where I was on my notes. Oh, yeah. Okay. So let me close with this. My family, and I'm all about open and honesty and authenticity, and we have very honest conversations here. My family, we financially support Harbor of Hope, Heartline Ministries, which is a ministry that supports women giving birth in Haiti, because we have a Haitian son, we have a heart for Haiti, and women in Haiti have a hard time giving birth because it's so impoverished. We support Young Life, and we support Compassion International. Now, I'm not saying that because, look at him, he's so... No. It's because what happens is if you have a heart for something, your money and time will follow. Or you give your money and time to something and your heart will follow. And for me personally, I don't really, when my wife said, we should support Heartline, I did not have a heart for Heartline. Like, I didn't care, you know, I didn't even know about them. But over time, as you give of your time and who you are and your values, and you pick faithfulness to God instead of the fear of what could possibly be, like, if you choose faith over fear, over time, your heart follows with you. And so, guys, choose faith over fear. Choose a life given fully over to God rather than a life motivated by guilt. Give at that fork in that road where it's God is calling you to something and you're afraid to take that step and you'd rather him just leave you alone. Take that step because his promises are always good. Don't run from the thing that you're terrified of that has no danger for you. Live by faith, not fear. Let's pray. God, we love you. We're moved by you. Like, I mean it. Like, when you enter people's lives and they take steps for you, it is this thing that is... It drives me crazy. Like, I've seen that stupid video 4 times, and every time it's gotten me. But this is the power of your gospel and what you're trying to do and how you set people free. And so, God, if there's anyone here today, and we're talking about money, we're talking about serving, we're talking about the sticking points where God calls them to something, but they don't want to take that step. Like, God, honestly, I ask you to set everyone free from guilt. Guilt was not my point today. My point is to motivate people out of love. The same way that God, Jesus, gave up everything for us, which was this treasure for him, we ask that you would make yourself the treasure in all of our lives that we would give up everything for. Let us all be people who choose to live a life marked by faith, not fear. Do I want us to be a community marked by generosity of their time, but of money? Absolutely. Is it because I need money? No, it's because you call us to live generously. You call us to love you more than anything else. And money's the thing that will probably be the sticking point for us. So set us free from love of money. Set us free from a love of our own comfort. Set us free from a desire to guard our own time and our own stuff and our own comfort and our own area. Set us free to a life lived passionately, recklessly, abandoned towards and for you. I don't want people's guilt money. I want them to give you the rest of their life. We love you. Amen.